Herman Melville published one of the great American novels in 1851. Just in case you missed it in high school, a quick refresher. We follow Ishmael. He's a crew member aboard the whaling ship, the Pequod. Its captain, Ahab, is a menacing figure obsessed with catching a whale he calls Moby Dick. The book is all about whaling, which used to be one of the most lucrative industries in the world. And it was partially inspired by the author's time in the seaside whaling town of New Bedford, Massachusetts. This is Off the Path from WSHU Public Radio, but we're calling this season of Maritime Tales and Explorations Off the Plank. Moby Dick opens as Ishmael stumbles down New Bedford's cobblestone streets at night, looking for a room at an inn.
Such dreary streets, blocks of blackness, not houses on either hand, and here and there a candle, like a candle moving about in a tomb. At this hour of the night, of the last day of the week, that quarter of the town proved all but deserted. But presently, I came to a smoky light proceeding from a low, wide building, the door of which stood invitingly open.
It's the Spouter Inn, where Ishmael's adventure gets set in motion. Melville might have had a similar experience when he came to New Bedford in the winter of 1840 and signed on board a whaling ship.
He was a mariner. He was a school teacher for a while. He didn't do very well at that, and he joined a merchant voyage.
Michael Dyer is a historian with the New Bedford Whaling Museum. He says sailors, like Melville and his fictional character Ishmael, kept New Bedford's economy running, but they were looked down upon by a lot of the locals.
These guys, they were out of sight, out of mind. The only time you saw them was when they were on shore, drunk, because they just came in from 2 years cruising in the Pacific Ocean. They hadn't seen a woman in a long time. They hadn't had any drink, and they didn't have any free time, and they came ashore, and they found the tavern, and they drank themselves blind.
New Bedford was an intentional choice by Melville. The city was one of the global centers of the whaling trade in the 1800s, along with the island of Nantucket.
How did New Bedford become such a famous whaling port? It was designed, laid out by a maritime culture to be the ultimate fruition of a maritime culture.
Boats and the sea were central to the life of New England's European settlers. After all, it's how they got here.
To understand early American history is to frame it within a maritime context. And this place where we're sitting, when English explorers came here, they said, that's going to be a great anchorage. That's a great place.
Remind people who don't know the terminology what it means to be an anchorage.
Well, a great anchorage is a safe harbor. It's deep water. It's navigable. It's protected from the wind and the weather.
The first whale fishery opened in downtown New Bedford in the 1760s. And New Bedford began to develop its distinct look as a New England port city with rope walks, sailmakers, and shipbuilding.
Unlike most New England towns, you know, if you have a picture of the Yankee magazine New England town, what does it look like? It's a square, green square, right, with sheep grazing and a white church with a big white steeple and nice houses around the square. That's not this place. This place runs from the top of the hill down to the waterfront, and along the wharves are warehouses. Be ship chandlers, blacksmiths, cooper shops, pump and block makers, all clustered along the waterfront. Then there were grocers, West India goods dealers, places where you could buy maps and charts and nautical instruments and things of that sort.
Herman Melville portrays New Bedford as a town that only exists because of whaling.
New Bedford is a queer place. Had it not been for us whalemen, that tract of land would this day perhaps have been in as howling condition as the coast of Labrador. As it is, parts of her backcountry are enough to frighten one. They look so bony. The town itself is perhaps the dearest place to live in all New England. It is a land of oil, true enough, but not like Canaan. A land also of corn and wine.
What was New Bedford like at that point? What would the town have felt like to walk around in?
Basically, in the area that you're in right now, they wouldn't walk around in because it was noted for a number of things that weren't very nice.
That's Fred Toomey, president of the New Bedford Port Society.
Across the street where the Whaling Museum is today, in the two-block area, were 28 barrooms and brothels. Not included in that was two floating brothels out in the harbor. So it was not a very good district for people to walk around with their families.
One building downtown was family-friendly, though, and Melville thought it was important enough that he made it the centerpiece of the first part of Moby Dick.
In this same New Bedford, there stands a whaleman's chapel, and few are the moody fishermen shortly bound for the Indian Ocean or Pacific who fail to make a Sunday visit to the spot. I am sure that I did not.
Ishmael attends a sermon given by a priest named Father Mapple. It's all about the biblical story of Jonah and the whale, of course. And it's full of maritime imagery to explain its religious symbolism. After all, Father Mapple would have been preaching to a bunch of sailors. Here's a bit from his sermon.
Delight is to him whom all the waves of the billows, of the seas, of the boisterous mob can never shake from this sure keel of the ages.
The Whaleman's Chapel in Moby Dick was really the Seaman's Bethel, a church in the middle of downtown New Bedford. It was completed in 1832 and still stands within the city's narrow cobblestone streets. A lot of local sailors would visit the church to pray for safety before their ships set sail from the town's harbor.
They were not too religious, but every time their ship would go out, they would always come in the day before.
Toomey says the Seaman's Bethel was built by the Quakers.
Most of the whaling captains and ship owners were Quakers, and that's how they got their money through whaling.
But it never functioned as a Quaker church.
They built it, they ran it, but they never had services here.
The first floor was a school with desks intentionally built to be uncomfortable because they thought it would help the kids learn better. You have to go up a narrow wooden spiral staircase to get to the room where Herman Melville used to worship when he was a whaler.
Okay, we are now entering the chapel, which is on the second deck of the Seaman's Bethel. Inside, you'll note that it doesn't appear to be a church, and that is primarily because the Quakers never believed in decorating their church with any artificial religious objects.
There are ways it does resemble a church, though. There are rows of white pews facing a huge pulpit against the far wall. One of these pews has a little marker on it identifying it as Melville's pew.
Herman Melville actually did come here many, many times. He always sat in the second pew from the rear.
Melville describes the pulpit itself as looking like a ship's bow. In fact, he spends a whole chapter just describing it in this big extended metaphor.
What could be more full of meaning? For the pulpit is ever this earth's foremost part. All the rest comes in its rear. The pulpit leads the world. From thence it is the storm of God's quick wrath is first descried, and the bow must bear the earliest brunt. From thence it is the God of breezes, fair or foul, is first invoked for favorable winds. Yes, the world's a ship on its passage out, and not a voyage complete, and the pulpit is its prow.
But Fred Toomey says when Melville attended church here, the pulpit looked ordinary. Now it resembles a ship's bow.
This was actually put in 1959 because of the clamor of people wanting a pulpit to be like what was depicted in the book.
Melville wrote about other haunting features of the church exactly as they were, and still are today. Dozens of marble and granite plaques line the walls with names and dates. They're called cenotaphs, memorials for New Bedford area sailors lost at sea. The oldest go back to 1835.
In memory of Captain William Swain, master of the Christopher Mitchell of Nantucket, this worthy man, after fastening to a whale, was carried overboard by the line and drowned May 19, 1844, in the 49th year of his age.
Melville mentions the cenotaphs in Moby Dick. He writes about how sad it is the sailors will never have proper graves since their bodies have been lost at sea.
Oh, ye whose dead lie buried beneath the green grass, who standing among flowers can say, here, here lies my beloved. Ye know not the desolation that broods in bosoms like these. What bitter blanks in those black bordered marbles which cover no ashes. What despair in those immovable inscriptions.
And these cenotaphs are still updated.
Unfortunately, we still have a tablet that is just come back from the engraver. We just had to inscribe three new names on it of a boat that went down in 2019.
Every year, New Bedford pays homage to Moby Dick with a 25-hour-long marathon reading. This year, I attended some of it until a storm threatened. We'll return after a short break.
Want to dig a little bit deeper into what's really going on in Connecticut?
Well, that's a complicated question.
I'm Ebong Udama. Every week on Long Story Short, I sit with some of the top journalists in Connecticut to find out what they're working on.
Yeah, so it was interesting how this story came about.
I think you'll see the legislature look at this again next year.
The money is still in the very early stages of coming to the towns.
Long Story Short from WSHU Public Radio and the Connecticut Mirror, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Off the Path. I'm Davis Donovan. New Bedford's Moby Dick Marathon started in the late 90s. It's not the only annual public reading of Melville's famous work. There are a few others, but it's probably the biggest, and it's the only one that takes place where and when Herman Melville, the author, actually set sail.
It's great American literature, which connects to people across the boards. Whether they care about whaling or not, many people actually care a great deal about great literature, and they love Moby Dick.
Historian Michael Dyer of New Bedford's Whaling Museum, which hosts the marathon, over the years it's taken on an energy more like a festival than a somber book reading. Hundreds of readers take turns reading 10-minute sections from the book from beginning to end.
There are people every marathon who stay awake for the whole 25 hours. They're there for the whole thing. You know, there are people who sleep in the museum. You know, you have to walk over them as you go through the galleries.
There's hot clam chowder for those who stay for the whole thing. Stephanie Clausen hopes to be one of them. She flew in from California for the weekend. This is her first time in New Bedford, but she's done Moby Dick marathon reads in San Francisco. She loves the endurance challenge of it.
I think it must be like people who run marathons. I don't. My sister does. I think you're sort of euphoric and exhausted. I mean, this is slow going theater, and you're in it for the long haul. And it does something, I think, just like the book, to your attention span, that stretches it out like a long whaling voyage.
Stephanie's looking forward to all her favorite moments on that long voyage.
Of course, the opening when you hear the eight bells and the whole journey starts. Then there's Fast Fish or Loose Fish, which is a really wonderful chapter kind of about free will. How do we make the decisions of our lives? Is it fate or do we control our destiny? And he puts it in the context of whaling. A fast fish means that you have a pole in it to say, this is my fish, no one else can take it. And if it's a loose fish, it means it's just out there in the world and anybody can take it. So your destiny.
Stephanie and hundreds of others pack into a spacious gallery in the museum. Some sit in chairs, some on the floor, and some spread out on board a huge replica of a whaling ship called the Lagoda that takes up most of the room in the gallery. A volunteer signals the start with the tolling of a ship's bell. And then it begins.
Call me Ishmael.
After the initial excitement, everyone settles in as readers take turns.
A tramping of sea boots was heard in the entry. The door was flung open, and in rolled a wild set of mariners enough.
It was now quite plain that he must be some abominable savage, a peddler of heads too. He might take a fancy to mine. Heavens, look at that tomahawk.
After 10 short chapters, the reading stops and everyone moves to the church across the street. It can only hold a few dozen people, so they hold a raffle to decide who gets in. This is when being a journalist comes in handy. The marathon goers take their seats and join in singing a hymn that appears in the book.
Let's rise and sing.
The young man who hands out the lyrics is dressed in a ruffled white shirt, a black cap, and suspenders. He's Cody Oliveira, a volunteer with the New Bedford Whaling Museum.
You've dressed up a little bit. Can you tell me about what you're wearing?
I'm just trying to be portraying a whaler from the mid to late 1800s.
Cody grew up coming to the museum.
I think this is the fifth time for me.
Ever had any problem finishing it?
It's a struggle usually when you get around 4 to 6, but at that point, you just got to keep going. I usually just say walk around, have something to eat maybe. It just varies on how you stay awake.
The marathoners leave the Seaman's Bethel and continue the readings back at the Whaling Museum.
Captain Ahab stood upon his quarterdeck. He looked like a man cut away from the stake.
"Haul in, haul in," cried Stubb to the bowsman, and facing round towards the whale, all hands began pulling the boat up to him. The red tide now poured from all sides of the monster like brooks down a hill.
But about 6 or 7 hours in, the number of people dwindles, from the curious to the serious. I leave because a dangerous storm is brewing and I have to get home. But I tune into a live stream when a local theater troupe arrives for one chapter that Melville wrote like a play in dialogue. It comes around midnight.
Well, and adieu to you, Spanish ladies.
Well, and adieu to you, ladies of Spain.
They're the sailors of the Pequod singing and sharing stories on the ship's upper deck or forecastle. Even fewer people are left now as the night drags on and Captain Ahab continues his relentless pursuit of Moby Dick across the oceans of the world. Spoiler alert, Ahab dies in his effort to kill Moby Dick, but we never find out if the whale survives. The ship sinks into the sea and only Ishmael lives to tell the tale. Michael Dyer, whom you heard earlier, reads some of the last words just before the epilogue.
Now small fowls flew screaming over the yet yawning gulf. A sullen white surf beat against its steep sides, then all collapsed and the great shroud of the sea rolled on.
Wow, what a weekend. It was so much more than I expected.
I checked back in with reader Stephanie Clausen, who did make it through the marathon.
So many book lovers of all ages there, all coming together for this crazy, long, weird 19th century novel that has so much in it. And the fact that it ended with a winter snowstorm just made it perfect. I can't wait to come back.
Historian Michael Dyer again.
Start to finish, it's a heartwarming thing. And, you know, I don't know about many things in life that you can actually, you know, that you can actually say that, you know, about.
He carries a beat-up old paperback copy of Moby Dick into our interview.
How long have you had this copy of Moby Dick? It looks like it's been around a little bit.
This was a 1986 edition. So I got this in 1986.
Well, how many times have you read Moby Dick?
I read it once a year.
Do you remember how you fell in love with the book?
Oh, yeah, I distinctly remember. It was a girl who told me I was a Moby Dick person. I was absolutely in love with this girl after high school. So I did. I got this copy.
And he's carried it around ever since.
I first read it when I was 19. It doesn't get any easier as you get older. It gets harder as you get older. You understand more about life as you get older. As you really start delving into the book, you're bringing your own life experience to it.
I'm pretty new to Moby Dick. I read it back in 2022 for the first time. And I've never been on a whaling voyage or even a particularly long boat journey. But I do like nautical music. And that song you heard just a minute ago, the one that gets sung in Moby Dick, it's one of my favorite songs of the sea and one of the oldest we know of, too. It dates all the way back to 1624. It's also the song Robert Shaw sings on the boat in Jaws.
Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies.
This song is called Spanish Ladies.
That's Lindsay Smith of the Ranzo Boys.
Although, if you want to get technical, this is a New England variant. This song is found in the text of Moby Dick, so we thought it was especially appropriate for this episode. And it's a shanty that would be used for longer tasks, like pulling up the anchor.
Farewell and adieu to you, Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain. For we received orders to sail for New England. And we hope in a short time to see you again.
Oh, we'll rant and we'll roar like true Yankee whalermen. We'll rant and we'll roar on deck and below until we sight gay head off old Martha's Vineyard. And straight up the channel to New Bedford we'll go.
I've been a ship's cook and I've been a rigger. I can dance, I can sing, I can walk the jibboom, I can handle a harpoon and cut a fine figure. Whenever I am in a ship's standing room,
we'll rant and we'll roar like true Yankee whalermen. We'll rant and we'll roar on deck and below until we sight gay head off old Martha's Vineyard. And straight up the channel to Bedford we'll go.
I went to a dance all one night in Tombaz. There were plenty of girls as fine as you wish, and one pretty gal was a chewin' tobacco, just like a young kitten a chewin' fresh fish.
We'll rant and we'll roar like true Yankee whalermen. We'll rant and we'll roar on deck and below until we sight gay head off old Martha's Vineyard. And straight up the channel to New Bedford we'll go.
Now let every man take off his full bumper, and let every man take off his full glass.
We'll sing and be jolly and drown melancholy, and drink a good health to each true-hearted lass. We'll rant and we'll roar like true Yankee whalermen. We'll rant and we'll roar on deck and below until we sight gay head off old Martha's Vineyard. And straight up the channel to New Bedford.